This is DiPietro, Canty, and Rothenberg.
Sports back, baby. Preseason hockey last night. We had the Mets playing like the Mets last night. The Yankees doing what they do last night. Basketball is back tonight. Hockey is back on Saturday. We've got Graziano today at 11 o'clock. We've got the Rangers head coach David Quinn at 12 o'clock. Sports is back in full force. So good morning, Chris Canty. How are you with sports?
I'm a little spicy this morning, Dave.
Why?
I am. The
Yankees
won like
50-2. I'm watching
Get Up
this morning.
Why are you spicy? I'm spicy this morning. I'm watching Get Up this morning, and Mike Tenenbaum and Dan Graziano are throwing shade toward the NFL players over the NFL Top 100 list. You got Chris Sims defending Adam Gase like Robert Shapiro, and Johnny Cochran defended O.J. Simpson for whatever reason. I don't know what's going on today in the world of sports. I'm excited that the NBA is back tonight, but I'm in a little bit of a spicy mood for a Thursday.
Yeah, you really
are spicy.
A
little bit spicy this morning.
And I got to be honest, Rick, if anybody should be spicy, it's you and I, not him, after the Yankees' performance and the Mets' performances last night.
Yeah, Dave, roller coaster of emotion last night. Oh. I got my Islanders' big win. I know it's only an exhibition game, but it's still Islanders-Rangers. Varlamov was unbelievable last night. I mean, if that's any indication of how he's going to play moving forward here, we're in good shape. I mean, you haven't seen, you know, Semien successful like that since Sean Kemp. I mean, let's be honest. And then you got the Mets. I don't know. Listen, if I'm Jacob DeGrom, you put your hands up.
What more?
I mean, what do you do?
What more can you do? It's every single game with this guy. And I'm not saying it was the entire fault of Robinson Cano, but I would have bet you every penny I have that he was not going to get a hit with two outs in the ninth inning last night. Like I there was no chance, Rick, that he was going to get a hit in that spot last night.
Yeah, forget that though. I mean, you got the umpire. I mean, clearly that's strike three to Moreland. I mean, that inning should be over. Of course, he doesn't, you know, decides it's going to be a ball, which drove me crazy. I mean, like, watching the Mets is like when I watch, like, when I'm coaching my son's T-ball team. Like, the level of frustration. Jimenez getting picked off. I mean, and then you got J.D. Davis in left field. I know it's a tough play, but, I mean, he's not a good left fielder.
Well, that's exactly it. He's not a good left fielder. So we say it's a tough play. He's not a good left fielder. He's not going to make that play most times.
And you had plenty of opportunities, and you know Jacob DeGrom looks like he's going to get a no decision, and then Keith and Ron say, "Well, unless something can happen here with two outs," and of course something does happen, and then the guy, and they actually get a run, and he's excited, he's going to get a win because you got Lugo, you know, coming into the game, and he gives up a home run, and then for some reason, and you guys explain it to me, I don't, Betances is up in the bullpen, he's ready to go, and for some reason Wilson, who clearly didn't have his stuff, is allowed to stay in the game, and then now all of a sudden it's a 2-run single, it's a 3-run game. Makes no
sense.
Yeah,
I didn't understand that. I thought that was a huge turning point in the game. I mean, isn't that why you have Betances? He's ready to go. He was fully warm. You bring him in the game, you get out of that, and then you have a good chance to win that game. You fall behind by 3 runs. You still almost come back, but I thought that was a really questionable move from Rojas last night.
Oh, no doubt it was a questionable move. I mean, the swing and bunt by Moreland hurt, but the base hit by Vasquez killed you because that scored 2 runs. Like, that was the game to me. But you did have an opportunity in the ninth. You had bases loaded. I mean, thanks to Brandon Workman, who decides he's going to walk the first two batters.
God.
But, I mean, Michael Conforto and the Yoenis Cespedes at-bats were absolutely ridiculous. Both of those guys had 2-0 counts, and they decide they want to swing on knuckle curves after Workman walks the first two batters in the inning. To me, that's inexcusable. But that's the thing that we talk about with the Mets. Even though they had 15 hits last night, having timely hits and quality at-bats has been something that's eluded this lineup. And then to compound the problem, sometimes they make some bonehead decisions with their defense and with their base running. And last night was just another classic example of that. It felt like the Red Sox closer wanted to give the game away, and yet somehow the Mets couldn't take advantage of it. It's got to be frustrating for a Mets fan.
I don't even know if frustrating is a strong enough word. I mean, I don't know. I mean, every time you turn on the television, you're expecting to see something different. And every single time Jacob DeGrom pitches, you see the same exact thing. And you're sitting there confused. Like, how can
and
this
you know
happen?
You know what's crazy about last night, Rick? The guys that you really depend on in the bullpen, the guys that you have the most confidence in, those are the guys that let you down. Those are the guys that gave it away. I actually thought Familia gave you a chance the way he pitched in the ninth. He gave you a shot.
And you had a shot. And that, again, makes it even more frustrating, is that you put yourself in position to actually to win that game, and you couldn't get the big hit that you needed.
Awful. Awful. You have bases loaded, nobody out. And I got to tell you, that was a big play from Devers to keep that ball in the infield.
Oh, yes, it was. That ball, he stopped on J.D. Davis.
Yes, because if that gets through, that probably ties the game up. But Cespedes, bases loaded, 1 out, 2-0 count, swings at ball 3. I mean, it is so frustrating to watch this team. And you know what, Rick, we've discussed this a million times. They're not a fundamentally sound team. Like, you look at the Yankees, there are teams you look at and you say, that is a fundamentally sound team. They're not going to give you the fourth out of an inning. They're just going to play baseball the right way. That's not the Mets. The Mets are a talented team, but they're a very flawed baseball team.
Yeah, I mean, it's a team that's not put together well.
No, exactly. I mean, not at all.
There's glaring deficiencies.
Same
and on top of it, I mean, the level of difficulty for the starting pitchers, I mean, you're not defensively, you're not doing them any favors. I mean, you're not making, you know, great defensive plays. I know Cano had that one good play early in the game where he, you know, Verdugo's slow ground ball that he made a nice play on. But, I mean, for the most part, Rivera wasn't great behind the plate. You know, Jacob deGrom threw two wild pitches last year. He had two last night. Because, Rivera clearly doesn't move well behind the plate. J.D. Davis is not a good left fielder. I mean, you name it. I don't even know, Dave, because every – in a 60-game season, you can't afford to lose games like that when you have your ace in the mound.
No, home doesn't really matter, I guess. But when you have DeGrom on the mound, and let's be fair, against a bad baseball team, and I'm not saying they don't have some talent, but that is not going to be a good baseball team in the Boston Red Sox. You have to find a way to win that game. You have to.
No, you absolutely have to, Dave. But that's not what the Mets do when Jacob DeGrom is on the mound. Since 2018, he's got a 2.04 ERA, and the Mets are 29-37 in those games. 29-37.
It's unbelievable. Best pitcher in baseball over the last 2+ years, and you're 8 games below 500.
You know what, Dave? And that's not hyperbole. Jacob DeGrom is the best pitcher in baseball. I'm a Yankees fan, and we got Gerrit Cole, and I think he's won last 24 games. But I will tell you right now, Jacob DeGrom is a better pitcher. Just watching him work, the way he throws the baseball is effortless. Even when he got in trouble in the fourth inning where he gave up those back-to-back doubles, like, he found a way to be able to right himself. He had a 1-2-3 fifth and a 1-2-3 6. Like, that's what great pitchers do. He gave you a quality start, and you would say that he didn't have his best stuff. You had an opportunity to win that game, and you just couldn't take care. You couldn't take care of your business. The guys that you depend on in the bullpen, the guys that you have the most confidence in, they let you down. And even when your offense tried to pick them back up, they found a way to give it away.
Here's the thing, Dave, you got to explain this to me. I mean, you're the Mets fan, right?
How come I have to be the voice of reason over a dysfunctional franchise?
Well, because I try to be positive, and then all of a sudden I go down to negative town. I mean, because the one positive that came out of last night, I mean, if there was a positive, was, you know, it seems like Pete Alonso's coming out of this thing a little
bit. Yes, was he 4-for-4 last night?
Yeah, and he had the, you know, bloop down the right field line. Like, those are the kind of hits that kind of break you out of.
Yeah, they get you out of
your slump. Explain this to me. I think we're on the same page with this. If Robinson Cano, who is not a great defender at second base by any means, right? Not a great defender at all, right?
Correct.
If it's hit right at him, he'll make the play, but otherwise not great. If the reason you had him on the team was because he was going to provide, you know, a really solid left-handed bat, if he's not good enough to bat higher than seventh in your lineup, why is he in your lineup?
You know why.
Money.
You know why.
But McNeil... McNeil clearly isn't. I mean, McNeil, if you watch the last couple games too, I mean, the one throw he made to Alonso, not last night, the night before, and they try to explain it. I think Steve Gelbs explained it, that he doesn't feel comfortable moving to his right, so he told Pete Alonso he's going to purposely bounce the ball to him. Right? Like, he clearly is not comfortable at third base. He has to be in your lineup. If Cano can't hit higher than seventh, why is McNeil not playing second base?
Well, because what are you going to do with Cano?
I can tell you what I'd like to do with Cano.
You're going to not play, but listen, I'm fine with that. You can ship him back to Seattle for all I care. But realistically, you think they're going to bring that in, that investment, trade the crown prince of your organization's minor league system, and that they're just going to not play the big piece you get in return? They're not going to do that.
The big piece was Edwin Diaz.
Well, it's supposed to be.
Okay, it's supposed to be Edwin Diaz. But here's the point, is if you're not worried about hurting his feelings by making him bat seventh, then sitting him on the bench should be an option.
Why not just be done with him?
Well, then sit him on the bench. If you think that Dom Smith is a better offensive option at this point, and you clearly like having J.D. Davis in the lineup, then have J.D. Davis play third, have McNeil play second where he's more comfortable. Cespedes is going to be your DH because you're worried about him and his legs. And then, I mean, have Dom Smith. Actually, Dom Smith looked pretty decent in left field last night.
Yep. He didn't look bad. Well, I'll tell you what, Rick, I don't think this is all that confusing or difficult to analyze. They're paying this guy a lot of money, and they're not going to not play him every day.
Yeah, but your defense can't be awful. I get with analytics and everything else, you're trying to maximize the offensive firepower in your lineup, but it can't be so, like, the discrepancy can't be so huge that you're just awful defensively and, you know, there are games when you're, I mean, you still got a ton of hits and you left 11 on base. So, I mean, you still offensively were fine last night. Big moments, you didn't come through. But your defense can't be that bad. Like, I mean, I get that Jacob DeGrom wants his outfielders playing in, but, I mean, they said it last night. And usually Ron and Keith, I mean, try to, and they're going to be overly negative, but they're like, why is, if you can't run back on a baseball, why are you playing so shallow? Like, Nimmo was not a good center fielder. He's not.
No. No.
And J.D. Davis is not a good left fielder. Like,
no.
You got to give and take. Like, you got to be an adequate defensive team.
We've done this exercise a million times. How many guys do you look at on this team and you say, that's a good defensive player?
There's not many.
Not many. Are there any?
Mariznick is a good defensive player, but
okay,
he's got the hamstring.
If he's going to play.
Yeah, no. Listen, I'm not disagreeing with you. I just, it frustrates the hell out of me. You still have to play decent defense. Like, you have to play good defense. If you're not going to play great defense, like, Devers is not a good defensive third baseman, look at his offensive numbers. Those are elite offensive numbers, so you can live with it. Cano does not have elite offensive numbers.
Elite? He doesn't have decent offensive numbers.
Nimmo was not an elite offensive player. I'd like him in the lineup, but I don't need him playing center field. Put him in left field where he's more comfortable. Keep Conforto in right field, and then put, when Mariznick's healthy, play him in center field. I don't care that he's got a light bat. He'll save you some runs in the field. Drives me mental.
Well, they're frustrated.
Every single game. Then I got Jimenez getting picked off.
Which is literally
those are all controllable things, man. It's hard enough to win when you play clean baseball. But now, all of a sudden, when you have mistake after mistake, I mean, and you got your best pitcher on the mound.
And you do him some favors once in a while. All the time.
It's unbelievable.
And you know what? I made the mistake, and I spoke to people yesterday before the game, and we all made the mistake of, all right, you've won two in a row against Boston. This should make it three. Now you get the winning streak. It's our own fault. I mean, you can't do that with this team because they typically find a way to take two steps forward and two steps back all the time.
I hear what you're saying, Dave. You're not supposed to look ahead, but when you have Jacob DeGrom, you got to pencil those in as wins, man.
But Chris, what does that
especially
mean?
Especially when you're going up against a team like the Red Sox.
What's their record with him on the mound over the last 3 years?
I know it's awful, Dave. It's 29-37. It's not very good, but you should be able to pencil those in as wins, especially when the guy gives you six innings of two-run ball.
You know what? I have to grow up. You can't. When DeGrom takes the mound.
Dave, I hear what you're saying, but you got a team that's built around your lineup. And your starting pitcher gives you six innings of two-run ball. If you lose that game, like that, I don't know what to say. I don't know what hope you have. Because all you got is a bunch of question marks with the starting rotation behind Jacob DeGrom. So if you can't get it done with that guy on the mound, like where are your wins coming from? What are we doing?
Then you had chances early in that game, too, to give him a lead.
Blown that game open.
Yep.
It should have been a laugher. Should have been, all right, you know what? You got Lugo and Betances and Diaz all ready to go today. And Wilson, because it should have been a laugher of a game last night.
And can we all agree? I think we're all even, I mean, we all said this at the time, too, so this is not Monday morning quarterback, that the decision to sign Jed Lowrie instead of going after DJ LeMahieu may go down as one of the worst decisions ever. I mean, DJ LeMahieu was...
He's terrific. And we said at the time, what did we say at the time? We said, no on Familia, bring in Ottavino, right? We said that a million times. And then we said, no, why would you bring in Jed Lowrie, bring in LeMahieu? And they went the opposite way. But you know why they brought in Lowrie? He's a Stanford guy.
Well, yeah, he's got a relationship with Brody.
Yeah,
listen,
that's exactly why.
I know. It doesn't make it right.
It makes it even more difficult to digest.
So the Mets are a retirement village for Brody Van Wagenen and his clients.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, you know what stinks? They're 3-3, and they should be 5-1.
Oh, yeah. Man. It's unbelievable.
They're 3-3, and they should be 5-1.
And what's amazing, too, is it looks like, I mean, when you watch Jacob, you know, DeGrom pitch over the last couple games, I mean, velocity-wise,
I was going to ask you about that. When did he start throwing 101 miles an hour?
I think game one.
When did that happen?
I think game one, he hit 100. I mean, he's worked on his...
You know, you used to Jacob DeGrom being around 97, 98. And I was just like, where did all of this velocity come from?
The guy's getting better, man. And that's... I don't know how he deals with it. I mean, he had a smile on his face in the dugout. I don't know how he deals with it.
Because what can you do? What can you do other than just smile and laugh at it? That it's so mind-numbing and unbelievable.
I don't know what you do. I mean, yeah, I guess you just go out there every fifth day and keep doing what he's doing. But, I mean, six innings, a two-run ball, and you're sweating over trying to get a win.
I mean, didn't you ever, I mean, you're a hockey goalie. Didn't you ever have games where you played great, you allowed a goal, and you lost 1-0, where you're just like, what more can I do?
Not every game, though, Dave.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
It's not every single game.
every game for DeGrom. Every game.
Right? You have two goals on 37 shots, and you lose 2-1.
You know what, though? In all honesty, watching that game last night, it felt like every other Jacob DeGrom start, honestly, over the last couple of years.
Yeah, that was a microcosm of the Mets. You saw a perfect microcosm of the Mets last night. This is exactly what they are. They're talented. They never come through for this guy. Their defense is not very good. They can hit the baseball, and in the biggest moments, they typically find a way to not get it done. That's the Mets.
Yeah, that's the Mets, and then it doesn't make it less frustrating. I don't know, man. I love the Mets so much, and they drive me crazy every time I watch them. Every single time. I mean, it's small things, too, and I get it. I'm being nitpicky, but, I mean, having played professional sports, I mean, those little things are, a lot of the time, they're the most important things. Like, There's a reason why the Yankees don't have facial hair. Reason why the Yankees make you wear, you know, certain color cleats. It's a team. It's a uniform. I mean, it all goes to, you know, it's not about me. It's about we.
Well, it's attention to detail.
Well, they get it. Yeah, it's attention to detail. Run the bases right. Like, do this, do that. Like, there are certain things you need to do on a consistent basis to have success. Like, I was always taught, you know, it's those little things that when you add them up at the end of a game, become the winning things. If you do all the little things right, by the time the game is over, you've done enough of those little things right that you win the game.
That's right. And the Mets they don't do enough of those little things.
Well, I think what you're talking about, Rick, is a level of accountability. You're talking about all the different things that the Yankees as an organization do. There's a clear standard and there's a clear expectation for each and every player. And with the Mets, it just feels like it's too much of do your own thing. You know, it's guys having lapses in mental focus, mistakes, base running errors, fielding errors, taking creative paths to the baseball when you're out in the field. Like, all of those different things add up and they undermine everything that the team is trying to accomplish. And that's how you get the result that you got last night. And at some point, the Mets as an organization have to take a stand and say, we're not going to do this anymore. I don't know when that's going to happen. But, I mean, until you get to that point, you're not going to have a team that's consistently winning. You're not going to have a team that's consistently in the playoff picture.
But I almost feel like this is our fault. Like, we know exactly what they are. No, I'm serious. You laugh. I'm not even kidding. Like, we know exactly what they are. We know that defensively, they're deficient. We know that they typically don't come up with the big hit in the big moment. We know that they don't run the bases really well. We know the attention to detail is not great. And yet, every time it happens, we're shocked and angry and frustrated like it's the first time we've ever seen it. This is who they are, Rick. Maybe it's our fault for getting frustrated at it every single time.
I hear what you're saying, Dave, but you don't expect that to happen every single week.
Happen
in every single series. You see examples of it in every single set that they play.
Right, that's my point. If it happens every single series, maybe that's just who they are. And instead of us getting frustrated, we say, you know what, this is who they are. Like the Giants, the Jets offense is awful. So are you going to watch the Jets offense and be like, I can't believe it's so terrible? Or just say, this is what it was. The Giants couldn't stop anybody. At some point last season, when that continued all year long, I wasn't going crazy. I was like, this is just who the Giants defense is. Maybe this is just who the Mets are.
This is who the Mets are, Dave, but here's the frustrating part about it in watching all of these games the last 3 years. I mean, the names on the back of the jerseys change, but you still see the same thing, which makes me think it's an organizational failure more so than the players. Now, the players aren't absolved of blame, but at some point, the organization has to change the way it's doing business because clearly their approach isn't working. It's too much inconsistency. We recognize that they have talent, but why can't you get your players to play up to their potential on a consistent basis? I guess that's the million-dollar question or the billion-dollar question, but I don't understand it. And I guess because I'm a Yankees fan, I see the contrast. I see the other side of the spectrum. But I put it to you this way. I feel for you guys because your baseball team shouldn't put you through all this. It shouldn't.
Yeah, but Dave, you can understand. I mean, I get it, what you're saying, and you're at a certain point. I mean, you see the same thing over and over again. You're going to be, you know, less and less frustrated. But, I mean, this is a new manager. This is supposed to be a new set of standards. I mean, there was supposed to be reason to believe that, you know, he would get the best out of these guys. He'd go hold guys accountable and everything else. And so far, we're seeing the same exact thing. And it's small little details, man, but it's, for some reason, it just drives me crazy. Like, I don't need to see guys wearing all different color belts. I don't need to see Cespedes up there with that stupid neon yellow arm sleeve. I don't. It bothers me. Like, Pete Alonso is the only one. I mean, him and Cespedes wearing orange belts. Why are you wearing an orange belt when everyone else is wearing the same belt? Like, what are we doing? Why are you mic'd up for the entire season? And if you're going to continue to make these mistakes, like, I mean, at some point, like, enough has to be enough.
Well, I mean, what are they going to do now?
There's nothing you can do now.
No,
but I mean, it's
you're
just
locked
at
in.
A certain
this
point.
This is who you are.
Yeah, but how many?
You hope.
You'd but
hope.
every single year, we come back to the same exact thing. And I know it's early on in the season, but it drives me crazy. You talk about these teams that have consistent success, right? It's do your job. Do your job. The Mets, it's been do your own thing. Well, what the hell does that mean, do your own thing? I mean, that's not a winning formula. It's ridiculous. You got the best pitcher in baseball, and every time he takes the mound, you're on pins and needles to see if this guy can win a baseball
game
for
you. That's right. Can you score two runs? Because that puts you in position to win. And last night, the bullpen blew it. The bullpen was bad last night. Guys you trust were bad last night.
But anyway, I mean, it shouldn't be at that point, should it?
No.
I mean, in all honesty.
It should have been a cakewalk. Last night should have been I'm going to bed at 9:11 last night because this game is completely over and I can go to sleep.
The Red Sox had one of the best offensive players in Major League Baseball. The best offensive shortstop didn't play last night for them.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Did not play. And I'm watching the postgame, and no one at any point that I hear anyone ask the question, why the hell is Justin Wilson still in that game when Betances is ready to go up against Vasquez? I don't get it. What do you have him ready for if you're not going to use him at that point? It's a one-run game. It's salvageable. But no. You leave man and he gives up
this
that
is the world
two
we live
run single.
In. You had a nice night last night, Chris.
Oh, it was a great night, Dave.
Yeah.
And we had three bombs. Another nice, tidy 9-3 win over the Orioles. Team we dominate down there in Camden Yards.
I think it's not even
16,
fair.
16 straight wins down in Camden. Yeah, we'll take that.
Yeah. Cole looked good. Home runs all
Cole
over the
looked
place.
Good.
Nice, easy win. That's
Judge
what the Mets should
good.
Have had last night.
What'd you say?
That's what the Mets should have had last night. Pound the other team into submission in late game. It's just, you know, you're watching it and your feet are up and you're relaxed.
Yeah, but the Red Sox are a better team than the O's, though.
Offensively, yeah.
Yeah.
Red Sox are a better
lineup
team
is
than
better.
The
yeah, but if you're the Mets and you score early and all of a sudden, I mean, the Red Sox are down three or four runs early in that game and they're going up against Jacob DeGrom. Like, okay,
yeah, you might
not
see a tap out.
Yeah, they'll tap
out.
They'll be done. We don't want this. We don't want this.
But no, they hang around, and then before you know it, you look up and you've lost the game that you should have won. Because you're right. I mean, listen, Luis Rojas at the end of the day is right. Seth Lugo is going to give up runs. Mariano Rivera gave up runs. Like, your bullpen is not going to be great every
right.
single
you can't
night.
You can expect that he's going to lock him down every time he comes into the game. It's unrealistic.
Exactly. In those cases, you're going to have, you know, someone get a big hit. Your offense is going to have to bail you out certain nights. And they had the opportunity. I mean, there was a perfect opportunity with what are supposed to be your best hitters up in a huge spot, and they didn't get the job done. They didn't. Conforto didn't have a great at-bat. Cespedes struck out, and then Cano hit the, you know, the weak fly ball to short. I just don't get it. I don't know, man. I just don't. At a certain point, I mean, it's just, I guess I'm just wasting my breath. If Cano's batting seventh, why do you have? He's not great defensively. What are we doing?
Because he's making $20+ million a year.
Yeah, I don't care, man. You already hurt his feelings. You're batting him seventh. Like, check your ego at the door. Well, what are you bringing to the table then?
He brings very little at this point because offensively he's subpar. Let's be honest. We've seen a year plus. He's not a very good second baseman offensively even anymore.
So what good is it playing him if clearly one of your best offensive players, who you need to be, you know, half decent playing defense because he's got to play every day, isn't comfortable playing third base, would feel much more comfortable playing second base. I mean, would make perfect sense. JD Davis is one of your better offensive players, and he's a better third baseman than he is a left fielder. I mean, you can see that. I mean, that's a hard play last night. That's a tough play for someone that doesn't normally is
any
not comfortable in the outfield.
Any left fielder makes that play.
Talkman, like, you name the Yankees outfielder that plays left field would have made that play last night.
Gardner, Talkman.
Every single time. And it's the subtle things. It's the subtle things. It's how quickly, how quick of a jump you get on the baseball.
Yeah, that's true too.
It's the angle you take to the baseball. And those aren't things that just naturally happen overnight. Like if you're not comfortable doing that, if it's not something that you've done for most of your life, you're going to be just average at it. You're not making plays that you're not making difference-making plays. And that would have been a difference-making play. Had he come up with that ball.
Absolutely. It's frustrating. But this is, again, this is what we've grown to expect. This is what they are.
You know, it's crazy. We haven't even seen Jared Kelenic with the Mariners yet.
When you see him and he's good, you're going to lose your mind.
Dave, we don't even have to see him to know that that was a bad trade, though. That's how bad Diaz and Cano have
been.
We don't have to see Kelenic to know that was a bad trade.
Right. If you got those guys for nothing, you'd almost say, I brought this salary on. And I didn't even get anything in return. Wait till you see what Kelenic is going to turn himself into.
Yeah, it's unbelievable, man. It really is. Like, the Mets were competitive in the second half of last year, but that was no thanks to anything that Brody did at all. But that's what happens when you hire an agent to be your general manager. You get decisions like what he made last offseason. That's what you get.
Yeah, it's very, very frustrating.
But what's even scarier, though, too, is how baseball works now is that Brody in the front office, the amount of say they actually have on what you see on the field with lineups and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, I mean, I don't know, man. I think they had an opportunity. Again, I shouldn't be surprised.
They should be 5-1. They absolutely should be 5-1, and they're sitting here at 3-3. And you should be annoyed.
I just feel like when you look at this team, there should be enough talent to not have a lot of these issues that we have creep up all the time. Like, there shouldn't be, I mean, these kind of mistakes. And I don't know, man. I don't think it's changing anytime soon. No, it drives me crazy. I mean, I get it. It's baseball. You're going to make mistakes. But there are a lot of mistakes this team makes that are just bonehead mistakes.
Even a pandemic doesn't change the... All right, training camps have started. NFL is back. Dan Graziano joins us here on DCR 98.7 ESPN. Good morning, Dan. We hope you're well and hydrated and doing okay during this crazy time.
Yeah, doing great. How about you guys?
We're doing as well as anybody else can possibly be doing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Hanging out, getting it done. All right, so let's get into it. So Nate Solder, we completely understand, opts out, but football goes on. I got to ask you these questions. Does that mean that the rookie is now lined up as your starting left tackle day one for the Giants?
I think the Giants would like that to be the case, and they may have liked that to be the case anyway. I mean, there was talk in the offseason after the pick was made about moving Solder to the right side. So my understanding is they'll proceed with camp with the idea of getting the first-round pick Thomas ready to play left tackle. If he can, if they feel like they can't handle it, they feel like they have some other options, but that would be the plan as I understand it.
Let me just follow up real quickly with you, Dan. Explain financially what this means to the Giants with Solder not playing this year. Does it mean they have more money now? Does it mean they can defer this money down the road? What is the financial ramification?
So by opting out, his contract tolls, which means it all moves forward 1 year. So the 2020 year becomes 2021, and he's now signed through 2022. Now, in terms of this year and the cap hit, he got a $3 million roster bonus in March. So that's already paid, and it's on this year's cap. And then at the end of the year, they'll have to add another – I'm assuming he's a high-risk opt-out because of his medical history. They'll have to add another $350,000. That's the stipend he gets for opting out. So at the end of the year, their cap will be charged another $350,000. So their cap hit for this year, as of now, for Solder will be $3 million as opposed to 19.5, which it was going to be. And then at the end of the year, they'll have to add another 350 on that. So what happens is next year, the salary, which is 9.9, and the proration of the signing bonus, which is 6.5, that all slides forward into next year. So his cap hit next year, unless I'm doing the math wrong, should be 16.5. So it helps them cap-wise this year and next year, but they still have to pay. Well, they don't have to pay him because it's not guaranteed. But if he stays on the roster for two more years after this, then the contract will be what it was supposed to be starting now.
Dan, is the NFL surprised at all with how many guys have decided to opt out so far?
I don't think there was much expectation. Well, I talked to somebody with the NFLPA the other day, and they said they were thinking it would be somewhere in the neighborhood of 15 to 20, and they're already at 31 as of this morning. So I guess they're a little surprised, and probably the league as well. But, you know, it's hard to predict these kinds of things. I mean, this is a very difficult decision for a lot of guys, and, you know, there are some, like Solder, that have extenuating circumstances that probably made it not as difficult a decision. Yeah, I think we'll see more. I think it is. I think the people who put the plan together are a little bit. They didn't expect quite this many, but you know, it's sort of like good for them, right? I mean, at least these guys aren't feeling like pressured to play in situations where they feel like they could put themselves or their families in serious peril.
Dan, 5 days ago, the NFL and the NFLPA agreed to an addendum on the CBA to address the issues of playing football in a pandemic, but that deal hasn't been signed. What's the holdup with that?
Right. Well, anybody who's listening, including you guys, who's ever done a contract, right, an employment contract, for example, knows that you can agree to terms, and then it's still got to go through the legal department before it's finalized. And that can be a long and maddening process, and I speak from experience. But that's where we are. So they agreed to the terms to get everybody to camp. And now what it is lawyers going over the final language of the agreement, and that's a process that takes some time, and you know, they hoped it'd be done by Monday. We're here Thursday. It hasn't been done. I talked to somebody this morning who said they hoped it'd be done today. So there's zero indication that there's any trouble or any holdup or any reason to think the thing could go south. But the interesting thing about it is players have until 7 days following the finalized agreement to opt out. So if the agreement was finalized today, players would have until next Thursday, August 6th, to opt out. So the longer it goes, the longer the time period is for these guys to have to consider and make this decision. So that's the one reason it's relevant. But no, I don't think there's any reason to think that the thing would fall apart based on anything I've been told.
Dan Graziano with us, NFL Insider, 98.7 ESPN. So obviously hockey, basketball in a bubble, so that's different. But baseball and football are similar in that teams are going to be traveling and going home after games and going on the road all over the place to play these games. Do you think the NFL and the commissioner of the NFL, Roger Goodell, looks at baseball and is kind of keeping a very close eye on that to see what works and what doesn't work of what to implement for his sport coming up?
The NFL is keeping an extremely close eye on baseball, as well as the European soccer leagues that aren't bubbled up. And they're trying to figure out, you know, what lessons they can learn from it. When the Marlins thing happens last week or earlier this week, when was that? I lose track of time now. Whenever the Marlins thing happened, there was some level of freak out in the league offices and around the league because, like, what happens now? But they're watching closely what happens. Are they able to limit the spread? It looks like the other teams that were in contact with the Marlins haven't had outbreaks, so that's good. So and on some level, the system's working. Now, they also have to figure out how did the Marlins outbreak happen, and did it happen in spite of the protocols? Did it happen because protocols weren't followed? Did it happen because of activity away from the ballpark by someone? And once those answers are found out, then that's even more educational, because as the NFL looks forward to a training camp and a season, they want to make sure that they can operate best they can. And if they have to change something in terms of rules or protocols based on what they've seen in other sports that are using similar systems, then they'll be in position to do that.
Yeah, but Dan, I understand. I mean, the Nationals so far haven't tested positive, haven't played the Marlins to this point. But isn't that apples to oranges? I mean, the nature of football, if God forbid,
yes,
you know, one of these teams has an outbreak.
Yes, right. Baseball players aren't breathing in each other's faces on every single play. So, yeah, there's definitely an acknowledgement that it's a different situation for that reason. And it's not apples to apples. The NFL does have its own unique challenges, but there's no one playing American football right now that they can learn from. So they're going to have to deal with that. But what they can do is take the lessons from baseball's process, especially as it pertains to limiting spread, right? So as soon as someone tests positive or as soon as someone shows symptoms, there are steps that each team and the league have in place in terms of what has to happen. They're all wearing contact tracers every single time they're in the building. So you can go back and see this person spent more than 10 minutes within 6 feet of these three people. We got to make sure these three people test them and quarantine them until we know for sure. So it's really a matter of, you've heard the league say it, they're expecting positive tests they're expecting people to get infected. The key question is how to limit spread, and that's where you see like these Oakley face shields that they want guys to wear, and other things they're doing to try and keep guys, as much apart as possible. No one knows if it's going to work. They hope it's going to work, and they think that they're putting things in place that will help it work. But we're not going to know, and if we're not going to know whether they can complete a season until they have completed a season. That's it. I mean, this is going to be a presence in this NFL season no matter what.
Dan, why are we seeing a disproportionate number of Patriots players opt out in comparison to the rest of the league?
That's a good question that I don't have the answer to. I wish I did. But I think it's guys making individual decisions, right? And maybe, you know, there's a Patriots group text that, where the conversation has you know, the concern is elevated to a certain level and guys are, you know, playing off each other for that reason. But I don't know. I don't know why it's more Patriots than other teams so far. Obviously, that's a tough break for them football-wise. But, I think guys are just making individual decisions, and that's sort of the way it fell there.
Dan Graziano with us here, 98.7 ESPN. All right, haven't even asked you about the trade from last week. Jamal Adams over the weekend, it happens. Did you feel it was going to happen? And give us scorecard. Who won this thing, Seattle or the Jets?
I think the Jets did very well here. I think, you know, this is a player that it had gotten very difficult to imagine him playing for them again based on, you know, the things he was saying about the coach and the GM and the organization. So that said, to be able to take a player that didn't want to play for you and you thought, you know, maybe I don't know how we're going to put him back in our locker room at this point and get two first round picks for him, I think that was stunning. The people I talked to around the league in the weeks leading up to that all said it'd be shocking if they got the Jalen Ramsey return, the two first round picks for him. It's a safety. People don't pay a premium for safety. So I think given the situation and how difficult Adams was making it for them, I think they did extremely well to get that return back from Seattle.
Dan, how much does the uncertainty with college football and what the draft is going to look like this upcoming draft, how much did that play into the Seattle Seahawks feeling comfortable giving away the two first round picks?
A lot. First of all, Seahawks, the way they look at the first round, they're used to picking like 25th or 23rd, or, you know, so they look at it and say, look, we're not going to get a guy at a pick like that that's better than Jamal Adams. So that's our first round pick for next year. But even more so this year, they don't know if there's going to be a college football season. They don't know if there is a college football season, whether the first round picks are going to play. You could be evaluating the entire first round of this year's draft based on 2019 tape of all these guys. It could be the most insufficiently evaluated draft in history. So if you're picking in the 20s, as Seattle is accustomed to and expects to, or ideally for them, the 30s, you're rolling the dice. And so that was part of their calculus without a doubt that, hey, we're not sure what a first round pick this year is really even going to be. This guy is a sure thing. He's 24. We know who he is. We have him under control for two more years. Obviously we know he wants another contract, but they felt like it was worth it. And the Seahawks are perpetually in go for it mode. I talked to Pete Carroll at training camp there 2 years ago. We were talking about the Browns, you know, the Browns were talking about, you know, were they building for the future and all that stuff? And Pete was like, look, I never understood this build for the future stuff. Like, you go for it every single chance you get. It was an awesome speech. I wanted to run through a wall when he was done. But that's how the Seahawks operate. They feel like they're always contenders. They always have to go for it. They have one of the best quarterbacks in the league, and they're constantly trying to maximize every chance they have to win with him. So it's a bold move by them, but they feel like they got a difference-making player.
Dan, in your mind, where does the acquisition of Jamal Adams put the Seattle Seahawks among championship-contending teams?
Yeah, I mean, tough division, right? You have the defending conference champions and the 49ers. No reason to think they'll be a lot worse this year. Arizona should be better. You know, I think it's, you know, you have the Rams who are still kind of hanging around. I'm not sure what they're going to be this year, but I don't think they're going to be an easy team to play. So when you look at Super Bowl contender, And now in a system where only one team in each conference gets the bye, it's going to be even tougher for the teams in the crowded divisions to get out of that with a good enough record to have a bye and ease their road toward the Super Bowl. So I think I like Seattle's team. I think they should always be considered a contender, especially as long as Russell Wilson is their quarterback. But in terms of, you know, coming out of a tough division in NFC West and beating out another team for the NFC title, I think it could be difficult for them this year. But I mean, you know, in terms of being a good team and being in position to contend, I think you have to put them in that. Yeah, you know, I think you probably look at New Orleans. I think people want to look at Tampa Bay and imagine what that's going to be. San Francisco coming off the Super Bowl, there's probably that kind of tier of, you know, quote unquote contenders in the NFC. And then right under that, I think there's a lot of teams, you know, whether it's Cowboys, Eagles, Packers, Vikings, whatever, Seattle would be in that group for sure as a team that has a chance.
Dan, is this the beginning of the end for Dak Prescott in Dallas?
Yeah, it could be, especially you look at next year's salary cap dropping, as we assume it will. It's going to be very, very difficult for them to franchise him again, which obviously puts a lot of shifts the leverage even further toward him. Now, you know, they could sign him. It's just a matter of them wanting to get to his number, which they weren't. And that number will only go up, obviously, a result of the Mahomes deal and probably a Deshaun Watson deal at some point. So he's in a good spot. You know, look, it's hard to forecast. If the Cowboys go win the Super Bowl and he's the MVP of the league, they're not going to have any issue paying him, you know, top-level money. They just didn't get it done this year, so it's possible he stays. But it's more likely now that he ends up leaving than it was, I think, a couple of months ago before the deadline came without a deal.
Dan Graziano joins us here in the show. Dan, this may be an unfair question, but, I mean, if anyone would know, because you're so well tied into the NFL, I mean, what is it? What's the reason? Do you have any idea why, you know, the Dallas Cowboys have been hesitant to – I mean, if he's your franchise quarterback, don't you just say, okay, we'll give you the 4-year deal as opposed to the 5-year deal?
Well, first of all, the Cowboys' offer was significant. I mean, they're offering him $34.5, $35 million a year. They felt like that was an offer he would take and that he should take. So it just wasn't what he wanted. And I know, talking to people on both sides, it's not an offer that Dak Prescott ever felt was disrespectful. It's just he had more in mind, and obviously once he's franchised, he knows what his worst-case scenario is, and it's a pretty good one. So I think it's not just the Cowboys being hesitant. I don't think they were hesitant. They just couldn't agree on the number. And in terms of 4-year versus 5-year, you know, it does make a difference in terms of how deals are structured. In the NFL, for salary cap purposes, you can spread a signing bonus out over up to 5 years of the contract. So if you give the guy a $20 million signing bonus and it's a 5-year deal, you only have to charge $4 million of that signing bonus against the cap each year. Whereas if it's a 4-year deal, you have to charge $5 million in signing bonus against the cap this year. Now, obviously, Dak was going to get a much larger signing bonus than that, but that just for purposes of easy math, you understand why a team would want the longer deal to help it with its accounting, especially, look, they just paid Amari Cooper, they just paid DeMarcus Lawrence. You know, it's not the only big spend they have on the roster. So I can see why they wanted it. You know, they would rather have had him locked up, and I think that he would rather be locked up by, you know, but it didn't work out, and they'll try again, you know, after the season.
Dan, we got to get to this NFL top 100 list. I have a hard time believing that NFL players could objectively look at Lamar Jackson's 2019 season and say that it was better than Pat Mahomes, or look at the player and say that Lamar Jackson is better than Pat Mahomes or Russell Wilson. Why do you think the players voted Lamar Jackson as the number one player in their ranking?
So you played in the NFL, right?
Yeah.
Like this was, yeah, right. So now did you ever get like a Pro Bowl ballot or a survey like this?
Yeah, you try to make sure that you vote so you get your guys in there and so they can get some shine. Right. Yeah, that's what it is.
Did you sit down and like dig in on the stats and then the research and like crunch tape and all that stuff before you voted? Or did you just kind of fill it out and send it back or maybe even forget about it?
Well, I don't think you got to crunch tape. I think players know who can play and players know who can't play. But you vote in a way to try to get as many of your guys into the Pro Bowl as you possibly can.
So maybe the Ravens team had more guys vote than the Chiefs did. Because think about this. Like, I was trying to think about it. Because this list is, I mean, all these lists are silly offseason stuff and whatever. But, I mean, I haven't ever really thought about this list before. They do it every year. But we were talking about it on the show this morning on Get Up. And so I looked. The NFL sends these ballots out around Thanksgiving every year, right? So let's just devil's advocate. I'm not saying they made the right call here. I disagree completely. Mahomes should be number one. But if you got this ballot on Thanksgiving weekend, the Chiefs were off that week. Mahomes was coming off kind of a lackluster game that was a couple weeks removed from two games he missed due to injury. And Lamar Jackson was coming off two straight games where he was over 70% completion through 9 touchdowns with no interceptions. It's not inconceivable to think that an NFL player could have received a ballot on Thanksgiving weekend last year and thought Lamar Jackson was a better player than Patrick Mahomes. And if they filled them out right then and there, I could see how it happened. And again, the Chiefs were off that week. Maybe they didn't fill any of them out. Maybe they all the ballots were sitting there under a whole bunch of incoming mail when they all got back from Thanksgiving, and they just never did it. And so there were no, you know, there weren't enough votes from Kansas City. These are all just theories.
Yeah.
The whole exercise is silly, so my theories are allowed to be silly too. But I thought, again, to the extent that I've ever thought about this list and this content, it was this morning, and that's what I sort of came up with.
All right, Dan, last one for me. I mean, what are you hearing as far as some of the unique things we may see from teams this season? I mean, we've heard quarantine quarterback. I really believe that some of these teams should try to figure out a way to get, you know, their guys into, you know, hotels maybe midway through the week and test them every day to make sure that they're healthy on game day. What are you hearing so far as some interesting things we'll see?
I think a lot of it's in terms of like the setup of the facilities, like teams, you know, because you have to space out the lockers, right? And you think about a training camp locker room, there's like, you know, if there's eight, even if there's down to 80 man rosters, it's still more lockers than you need during the regular season. So some of these facilities aren't built for it. So they're kind of converting like unused spaces, like a media workroom, because even if we're allowed at the facility, we're not going to be allowed to sit there and work, into auxiliary locker rooms. One team told me that, you know how like in locker rooms, I'm not sure people know, but like they're kind of loosely grouped by position, right? Quarterbacks would be in one corner, the offensive linemen could all be along the same wall. They're mixing up, though, even as they're spacing them, they're mixing up position groups because they feel like those guys have already spent a lot of time together on the field, will limit the amount of close contact they have when they're in here. So it's a lot of stuff like that. And in terms of going into the season, we don't know yet exactly what the roster rules will be. I believe that practice squads will be expanded and you'll be able to move guys on and off practice squads without sending them through waivers if you're doing so for COVID-related reasons. But yeah, in terms of quarantining players in position groups to make sure you aren't decimated at one particular position group, I would not be surprised to see teams structure practices this year to make sure that certain guys in one position group are separated from others in their same position group, because you don't want to get to a Sunday morning and find out your entire secondary tested positive and now you have to play a game without them.
Dan, before we let you go, I want to ask you about DeAndre Baker. He was placed on the commissioner's list earlier this week. What's the expectation for folks around the league on his future with the Giants?
I think the Giants have taken the stance that they're going to wait and see what the league decides. Once it's finished its investigation, obviously they're going to wait to see what the legal process bears out in terms of DeAndre Baker. You know, commissioner's exempt list right now, which I guess he's appealing the placement on the commissioner's exempt list. I'm not sure one of those appeals has really ever succeeded. So I think he's going to have to wait, and I think it'll probably take a while before the commissioner's office makes a decision on him. Obviously, I don't know enough about the details of the case to really speculate, but I think it's, you know, there's some thought that obviously, I mean, they should probably be making plans without him, because I think they'll be without him for at least a portion of the season, if not all of it.
All right, Dan. Listen, we're closing in on hopefully on opening day of the NFL. We look forward to talking to you.
Nice.
As we get closer and the season gets ready to kick off. So good stuff. We appreciate it.
Thank you guys for having me. Take care.
Absolutely. That is Dan Graziano breaking down a little NFL for us, thinking that, Rick, that the Jets did pretty well in this trade, getting two number ones. See?
Yeah, they did. I mean, Joe Douglas made the best out of a bad situation. You just hate the fact that it got to this point.
That you were forced to trade your best player, yes.
But that's the whole point of drafting. I mean, you identify who you think is going to be, you know, the best player at the sixth overall pick, and you hit on it. I mean, usually, the draft is a crapshoot, let's be honest. And you drafted a guy who was on a Hall of Fame trajectory. That's a guy you'd like to keep.
Yeah, look at their last decade. Of first
I'd
round
rather
picks.
Not. No,
I'm not giving you a hard time. Like, look at their last decade of first round picks and look at how bad it's been. And you actually hit a home run on one and you were forced to trade him.
Well, I mean, there still is one that's in New York. I mean, he's not completely out of New York.
Stop it.
Wow.
Why do you do that?
What? You just want, you know, you just took me like back the, like, whole decade.
I feel like it's like you think I'm attacking you when I'm just having conversation on a sports talk show, and you feel like a cat that's cornered, and then you come out like doing anything you can. Well, you got a guy that stinks also, and he was ours.
and you traded a third round pick for him,
right?
You know what the other thing I thought too with the whole Jamal Adams situation, and I mean, I'm still a little bit surprised that they got the two first-round picks. I think the fact that, and that's the reason why I asked Dan, that, you know, there may not be college football, or who knows what the hell it looks like. I mean, maybe it was the reason why Seattle decided to give the second first-round pick. But the first thing I thought when he got traded And I forget what I was watching, but they're going over his numbers and, you know, how good he was against the run and, you know, inside the box and everything else. And the name that kept coming up in a lot of those stats was Landon Collins. And I was like, why? I mean, Landon Collins was all pro. He was in the defensive player of the year conversation.
Yep.
And if you weren't going to sign him, why wouldn't the Giants have traded him?
It's mind-boggling.
It makes no sense at all.
It never will. Not wanting to keep him was fine. Not trading him was incredibly naive.
But you're talking about production-wise. I mean, close to the same level as Jamal, production-wise. Like, he was on a similar trajectory.
Yeah, and he had real value, and you had the trade deadline. And you
and
didn't
he was
plan
far
to keep
less
him.
Of, and he was far less of a pain in the ass than Jamal was.
Well, he wasn't a pain in the ass at all.
Then you let him walk instead,
yeah, for
of,
nothing.
Instead of trade. That for still does not make any sense.
Pick. Very big deal. That extra pick at the end of the third round.
Makes no sense at all.
It makes no sense at all. It makes no sense
just,
at all.
Right. It's amazing to be in a city that has two of everything in these teams. They cease to amaze you.
All right. We want to remind you, you can listen to us anywhere you go. Click listen live at ESPNNewYork.com. Find 98.7 ESPN on the ESPN app or the TuneIn app, or simply tell your smart speaker, play 98.7 ESPN. At 98.7 ESPN New York, we go where you go. We bring in our favorite, right, Chris Canty, our favorite head coach.
My God, Dave.
That's right, our guy and coach, Coach Quinn with us here on 98.7. Coach, I even got Rick to admit yesterday he's rooting for the Rangers against Carolina.
I love it. He's coming along. He's going to take some time, but he's coming on the right side of this thing.
That's right. It's all about baby steps. All right, so last night, first game in months and months and months. How was it? How'd you feel your guys did, and how'd you feel the hockey was?
It was good to be behind the bench coaching a real hockey game. The atmosphere certainly was odd, but I think once the game got going, guys kind of just started playing hockey again. Didn't love what went on last night from our end of it, but didn't hate it. I thought there was some good things, but certainly things we're going to have to do a lot better if we're going to have success against Carolina. So kind of a mixed bag in a lot of ways.
All right, Coach, before we get into the meat and potatoes and some hockey questions, I want to know, because we're here in, you know, New York, we don't get the same coverage of the NHL, you know, bubbles. What is it like, you know, what is the day like for you guys, and how challenging have, you know, the last couple of weeks been on you and your staff to try to deal with all this?
You know, Ricky, oddly, it hasn't been that much different. I know everybody has been talking about the bubble and all the restrictions and things like that. The league has done an incredible job of making it as normal as they possibly can. And, you know, Ricky, at the end of the day, when you go on the road, you have some meals, you sit at the hotel, and you practice or play. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think when someone tells you you can't do something, everybody raises their antenna and gets all flustered by it. And even if you're not really going to do what you're not supposed to do. So I don't think it's really going to be that big of a difference now. Well, hopefully we're fortunate enough to be here for 3 weeks or 4 weeks, however long, you know, this tournament's going to play here. And it might feel different in 3 weeks, but it's been really a lot of normal things that we would do on the road anyway.
Coach, a lot of times we talk about the jump that young athletes make at the professional ranks from year one to year two. And I wanted to ask you about the things that you've seen from Kako and his development. I noticed that you had him playing on the third line, but you're flirting with the idea of giving him some top six time. What do you envision his role being once we get into the qualifying round? And what have you seen from him from when you shut down to now?
Just a more confident, comfortable player, a guy who, you know, steps out on the ice and there's not a lot of uncertainty. I think he's comfortable in his environment. You know, this kid came over here, everything was new, from his teammates to where he was living, to the language, to the league, to everything. And that's a tall burden for an 18-year-old kid. And, you know, I think this break has done him well. I think he's come back with definitely more swagger. He's way more confident. He's way more comfortable. And, you know, we're going to keep these lines the same to start. But, you know, that being said, things could change as this series goes on. And he did play a little bit with Panarin and Strome last night. I actually gave him a few shifts with Kreider and Zibanejad. So, you know, this guy's going to be a top two line player for sure. The question is when, and it may be from time to time during the series.
I know you know that this question is coming, and you can break the news right now if you'd like.
All right, here
on
we go. Here's the goalie question. Right? I feel it coming. It's the goalie question.
It's got to be asked. So let's get it out of the way. Let's ask the question. Who will you start Saturday noon against Carolina?
it's either going to be Georgiev, Lundqvist, yes, or Shesterkin. And I did that in alphabetical order.
But, Quinny, it is a nice luxury to have, though, right? I mean, the fact that, you know, Hank has the track record, he's you know, taking his team where he's taking them in the playoffs. He's got a great record against Carolina. I mean, it is nice to know that you have, you know, if God forbid, because I'm just, me personally, feels like it's going to be Igor that starts on Saturday, but just to have that in your back pocket, knowing that you can go to Hank whenever you need him, right?
Without question. I mean, these guys have all looked good since we've been back, and it, you know, everyone talks about it's a problem. There are worse problems to have than having three really good goalies. So it's better than having none. And they've all handled it great. Hank's been unbelievable since he's been back. He's looked good. He's looked happy. He's excited about playoff hockey. And, you know, we're very fortunate.
Coach, what's going to be the key for you guys in your series against Carolina?
Well, we need to stay on top of them. And it's something we've talked about. The last game we played them, probably our best game we played against them since I've been here. And one of the things I thought we did a really good job taking away time and space. You know, I thought we didn't fuel their offense. They're a team that really thrives when you make turnovers. And off the rush or in the offensive zone, the blind passes to the middle of the rink, the whole plays will kill you against this team. And that's what they live off of. And if we can, you know, defend the way we have been, I thought the one thing I liked, I mean, you know, there were some things, I know there was some guys I thought that didn't have good nights and things like that. But I thought structure, I was really curious how we were going to look in our own end and look defensively. And I thought we looked like we did when the break happened. I liked what we did defensively. I liked the way we handled rush coverage. So that was really what I was focusing on last night. And, you know, guys hadn't played for 4 months, so I'm going to give some of them a pass or things like, or give them a little bit of wiggle room because of the circumstances. But, you know, we've got to, as long as we're defending and we do that with the puck, we're going to have a chance to win the series.
David Quinn, the head coach of the New York Rangers, with us here, 98.7 ESPN. Coach, you're going to deal with something you've never dealt with before. Really, in essence, you're going from a preseason game, and I know they call it the qualifying round, but for all intents and purposes, this is the playoffs. Like, how do you prepare? How do you prepare, and how do you prepare your team to go from 0 to 60 in such a quick span?
Well, I think it's a balancing act of feeling prepared, but also not doing too much, because at the end of the day, it's hockey, and the things we did throughout the regular season to have the loudest to have success against Carolina, we're going to have to do on Saturday, and the stakes are just higher. And I mean, Ricky, you know this. That's just the way it is. But that being said, you spend more time preparing for the team. The pre-scouting's more detailed. You're going over the players individually with things you don't do during the regular season. But when the puck drops, there's really no difference. I mean, the stakes are higher. That's the only difference. And you've got to be able to do the things that you did throughout the season to allow you to have success.
Yeah, it ends up being the team that can make it the most normal. Usually, is the team that ends up being the most successful.
Yeah,
you've seen that plenty of times.
I mean, yeah,
guys,
think, oh
guys
God,
routine.
We're in the playoffs. Oh, my God, what are we going to do? No, there's two nets. There's a couple of blue lines, a center red line, and they're going to have five out there, and we're going to have five to start the game. So there's really not going to be much difference. But like I said, the stakes are higher.
Coach, the one thing I did notice in last night's game, and I think that was the perfect matchup for you guys headed into the playoffs, just of, you know, the style of hockey that the Islanders play. It's a rivalry, so the intensity level is going to be, you know, naturally ratcheted up, is that I feel like sometimes you playing against teams like the Islanders or a team like, you know, Carolina that thrives on, you know, reducing your speed in the neutral zone and, you know, creating turnovers, that you guys tend to get frustrated once in a while. Is that something that you've addressed with the team a little bit? Just stick to the game plan and eventually we'll break through?
Well, that's what happened. I mean, the first 26, 7 minutes, I liked a lot of things we were doing. We were spending, you know, we were out shooting them. We spent time in the end. And then you could just sense it's 0-0 when we started getting frustrated and forcing plays and playing slower. And, you know, listen, that's a tough team to play. They've got pros up and down their lineup. They're an older veteran group. They really make it hard for you to get on the inside. And, you know, one of the things I didn't like last night, I thought, you know, if we had a chance to lean on someone or fight for ice to get on the inside, we took the path of least resistance. We stayed on the perimeter. And that's why that's why we scored one goal. And didn't really muster a lot of high-end chances against them. You know, I didn't love what we were doing in the O-zone. I thought we were very defendable too often. And, you know, but again, you know, I bit my tongue and tried to manage my anger throughout the game and post-game because, you know, you gotta keep everything in perspective. And I didn't want to lose a bullet last night. I wanted to save him for the series.
Coach, I would say this, though. Sorry, Candy, just to follow up. Yeah. I would say this, though. Listening to, you know, not only your press conference, but some of the guys after the game, like, you know, I think, you know, Kreider being one of the leaders on the team kind of stood out to me. I know you hate, you know, some of the things that happened last night and that you lost the game and everything else, but the PK was good. Your goalies were good. And then to hear Kreider say that, you know, how upset the guys were that they lost and they're going to head into Saturday with a bit of a chip on their shoulder. I mean, that has to be encouraging as, you know, as the coach of this team, no? It says a lot about the leadership in that locker room.
Very much so. And like you just said, I mean, we got good goaling. Our PK was good. Our D-zone structure was good. Things that, you know, that we know, you know, that have taken a long time for us to get good at. The you know, to not play well last night and, you know, they get two rush goals. One was very fluky when Foxy kind of lost his guy, and he had a heck of a night. I thought he played well. But, you know, they were just, you know, to give up two goals, play, you know, not play well, that's what we haven't been able to do, is can you have not a great night and also have a chance to win a hockey game? And we had a chance last night to win a hockey game. But, you know, all you need to know about, you know, where we were, our power play didn't get a scoring chance. We barely had a shot on net. So I think that can kind of give you an indication of where some of our players were last night.
Coach, that's why I love you, because you're leading me into my next question. Once we get to the playoffs, you're talking about heightened focus on the fundamentals of the game, not making any mistakes and taking advantage of the mistakes of your opponent. And last night, your penalty kill did look great. But I wanted to ask you about the state of your special teams. How are you feeling overall going into the playoffs?
Feel really good about a penalty kill. And if you watch us in practice on Monday, we did PP in zone. I mean, we walked out of it thinking we had the best power play in the league, and we were killing. I mean, our guys were getting after it. It was a game-like deal. And then you walk out of last night and you shake your head and you go, what the hell happened? So I have faith. You know, I don't have any doubt our power play is going to be good. It's been good all year. I really like our penalty kill. I like the direction we're going. I like we worked out an awful lot. So, you know, I feel good about our special teams.
Head coach of the New York Rangers, David Quinn, joining us here, 98.7 ESPN. No crowd. You mentioned that earlier. Playoff hockey, right? We start on Saturday. Is there some advantage to the younger player, and you guys certainly have a bunch of young kids on this team, to not have to play in front of a hostile environment on the road?
That might be the case. That being said, the games in Nassau Coliseum, and you talk to our veteran players, the two games we played in Nassau Coliseum this year, without question, were playoff atmospheres. And I know the stakes weren't as high, but when you're in an atmosphere like that, you don't really think about the stakes. That atmosphere creates, you know, an uncomfortable environment for some players. It didn't do that to us. That's why we won both games there. And, you know, the thing I loved in Nassau Coliseum in those situations, our young players didn't fold. Our young players impacted the game in a positive way. And we, you know, first game we played down there, they outshoot us 17-8 because we had beaten them 6-2 two nights prior. And we were down 1-0, and we rope-a-doped them a little bit. We got out of that period, you know, only down 1-0. And then the second period, they got their first shot 6 minutes into the game. So, you know, that to me, you know, people always talk about our team and when did you think you had a chance to be good. It was games like that that we thought, you know, we got a chance to be pretty good.
Yeah, and I think you guys have proven that. Coach, last one from me. And he got into a fight last night, but I mean, I love, and I've said this to you a bunch of different times, I mean, having that, a guy that can actually play, but also bring, you know, be a tone setter, be that physical presence, protect his teammates. I mean, how much does it hurt not having Lemieux for the first couple games of the series?
Yeah, it's going to hurt us. I mean, he's, like you said, he brings an element that we don't have a lot of, and, you know, he's had a really good week in practice, too. I really like the direction his game's gone, and it's going to hurt us. But that being said, we have faith in the other guys. You know, McKeg's played well. Howden, DiGiuseppe, Gauthier. I mean, those guys have done some good things for us. So, you know, every team's got their challenges, with whether it be injuries or suspensions, and we've just got to overcome it.
Coach, I know there's nothing like playoff hockey, but I got to ask you this. This is different because we're going with two hub cities in a bubble. Do you think that fans not being in the arenas is going to affect the gameplay on the ice?
I don't think so. Chris, I really don't. I think, again, because the stakes are so high, and, you know, the one thing I think that's happened is the league has done an incredible job in making players and everybody feel safe in this environment, and that's allowed our players to really focus on the winning and the losing, you know, focus on the game at hand and focus on doing everything they can to win this series. So, and I think every team probably feels that way. So, You know, I think it might be a little, I think when the game starts, but once it gets going, I just think you're playing hockey and your competitive juices take over, and you know, your desire and your will to win games will make it feel like a playoff hockey game.
All right, I lied. I mean, you're the best there is, so I have one, obviously one more question. Now, this caught me off guard because, you know, every time you come on, we talk about, you know, Panarin and we talk about Shesterkin and we talk about how good Meek has been. Am I nuts? I would have put if I was, you know, Dave Rothenberg in a real degenerate, I'd be betting on games and awards and everything else. How is Mika not a finalist for the Selke? Can you explain that to me, please?
Yeah, I listen. It's hard to, you know, people know how we feel about him, and it's just I think that happens in a lot of sports. A guy that deserves it usually gets it a year later, right? The guy when he has that bust out year, sure it happens in the Pro Bowl, right, Chris? A guy that has a Pro Bowl year, you know.
Yep.
Doesn't get it that year, he gets it the next year, partly on reputation, whether he has the similar year that he did when he deserved it. So I think that happened to Mika this year.
Coach, joke. Listen, we want to talk to you often, and we want this to be a long run, and we want to be there throughout, and we want to talk to you, you know, after you win the Stanley Cup. So let's get this going on Saturday.
It's a hell of a plan.
Right? Sounds good to you, doesn't it?
That's right. Hey, sounds outstanding to me.
Quinny. Just that this is a semantical question. Where are you guys getting dressed? Do they make separate locker rooms? Well, how do they do the locker room situation?
We were in the Leaf locker room last night. So
oh, nice.
We had a pretty good gig. Last night.
It's a sweet setup.
Yeah, it doesn't stink.
I actually wanted to check out of my hotel room and just stay there for the next 3.5 weeks.
All right, Coach. Listen, really, good. Best of luck. And I know all of Rangers Nation is rooting for you. We'll watch you guys. We'll listen to you guys here on 98.7. Good luck, and we'll talk to you soon.
All right, guys. Always great talking. All right,
great. That is, of course, the head coach of Chris Canty's New York Rangers, the great David Quinn.
It's got to be weird, though, Dave, playing in a playoff game with no fans?
Of course.
That's got to be strange, man.
It's going to be bizarre.
Initially, it is. I mean, I've been in situations like that. I told you, we played the Eastern Conference. I mean, it's not the NHL, but it was Game 7 in Bridgeport, and there was 11 people.
How is it possible you played in Game 7 of any professional series and 11 people went?
That's a great question. The best part is this. When I was doing MSG, I was telling that story, and Alan was on with me. Alan was one of the 11, and Ray Dinahan was another one of the 11. So two of the 11 are people I actually knew at the game.
You work with, like friends.
But usually in that situation, everything, I mean, you don't even, Chris, you know this, the best games that you play, you don't see or hear anything. So you don't even notice what's going on.
You know what? You're right, but in the pregame, though, it kind of allows you to get your mind right when you feel the atmosphere, the energy that's coming from the fans, whether it's positive or negative. Like, that helps you get in the mind frame to play a game. You know what I'm saying?
That's the most jarring.
It makes it different from practice.
Like, yep, agreed.
I couldn't imagine getting myself in that mode and not having fans in the building.
But see, that's why I asked the Brendan Lemieux question, because a guy like that, you know, go out there in his first shift.
Yeah,
like, I mean, mm-hmm. I even said that about Jamal. Like, this year in the NFL with no people in the stands, like, a guy like Jamal that has that kind of, you know, just every single day brings that kind of
that
emotion.
That can wake guys up, right? If it's kind of dormant and quiet, sure.
Those tone setters. And you know what I love what he said? And this is almost, would tie, you know, perfectly into the conversation we were having about Thibodeau with the Knicks. And he said this to us every single time we have Coach Quinn on. He always says the same thing, and it's talking about structure and D-zone and everything else. And the point he makes, which is the best point, and it's the job of every good coach, is to raise the floor of your team. So every night you give yourself an opportunity. Like, you don't have to always play your best, because there's no chance in 82 games you're going to play your best. But if you can raise the floor to a point that even when you don't have your best nights, you still give yourself the opportunity to win, I mean, that's huge. The fact that they didn't play well and it's a 2-1 game, I mean, that's what you want as a head coach.
Yeah. Yeah, they're a talented team. I mean,
because before,
I mean,
just remember that
they're going to run this playoffs.
Just remember this team before, though. I mean, before, you know, we started this, and it wasn't even a rebuild, really. I mean, it happened a lot quicker than we thought. Is you'd have nights where you'd watch this Rangers team play, and they didn't have their best stuff, and it wouldn't even be and there was no chance they were winning.
No, it feels like, listen, I don't know what they're going to look like now, because it's been a long time, but it feels like, and he said this to us a lot over the winter, even when they weren't playing well, they were a better team, right? Like, they were playing good hockey even when they weren't playing good hockey, if that makes sense.
And that's the most important thing. I mean, that's how you create consistency.
But
that's
isn't that
how
what
you
talk about with DeGrom? DeGrom can have his B-level stuff and still find a way to get the win.
You saw with DeGrom last night, it didn't necessarily have his A-plus stuff. And, I mean, the first two starts for Cole, I mean, early on in that game last night, Cole didn't have his A-plus fastball. I mean, he was throwing it, but it wasn't locating well. And, you know, finally he settles in, figures it out, and then, you know, he does what he does. That's what separates good from great, man. is that kind of is on the fly figuring it out when you don't have, you know, when you don't feel great or you don't have your best stuff.
Exactly. Because you're not going to have it every single game.
No. And I actually, to be completely honest, watching that game last night, I was surprised with how good it actually did look with all the time they had off. Mm-hmm. These matchups for both of these New York teams, and this isn't even being the homer, I actually like the Islanders and the Rangers both in these series.
Oh, that'd be great. I'm rooting for both teams just because I'd like more hockey conversation. I'd like them to both move on. Now, I will say this, Chris. If the Rangers lose, I don't want the Islanders to win. But if the Rangers win, I'm fine with the Islanders winning. I think that's
fair. Remember this.
So everything is contingent on us beating Carolina. As long
yeah, because I don't
Carolina,
want the Rangers to lose.
Matter
the last thing I want to have happen, and I think you understand this as a Rangers fan now, you don't want the Rangers to lose and then have him, you know, prancing around with the Islanders moving on in the playoffs and holding it over our head.
No, I don't want that at all, Dave. No.
It'd be terrible.
No, remember this too, though. But remember this too. I mean, we are here at 98.7 taking some of the Islanders games too. And those noon games do affect what time we get off, Dave.
Yeah, that's a valid point.
That's a valid point.
Still can't root for the Islanders.
Yes, you can. First series. At least the first series do it for me.
I'll root for them as long as the Rangers are in. Is that fair?
That's fair.
If the Rangers are winning, I'll root for the Islanders. But once the Rangers are done, that's it. I'm done.
Okay. I'm fine with that.
Right? How great would it be if we could see these two teams in the Eastern Conference Finals this year? How good would that be for New York?
That'd be awesome.
It would be amazing. The only disappointing thing was you wouldn't get a chance to see that live because I mean all three of us would be at those games.
If they were here in New York,
yeah. Quinny missed an opportunity though. I feel like I would as a liaison or assistant coach, whatever you want to call me. You don't have to pay me anything. I feel like I could be a huge benefit inside of a bubble situation.
How so?
I feel like I could bring a lot to the table.
Yeah, but that's what worries me about it, too, though. Because I think you'd be bringing more than just what you're bringing to the table.
You'd be the Lou Williams of the NHL.
I don't trust Rico. Yeah. I think you'd be trying to facilitate some players' greatness in there.
Yeah. What started as a funeral ended in wings.
Standing in the hallway of the hotel in like a rain jacket. What do you need? What do you got? I got what you need.
Give me the guy.
I got what you need.
Yeah, I can give you this. I got this.
You got a freaking catalog.
That's right. All right, guys. Rangers hockey is back, and MSG is helping you throw the ultimate viewing party with a brand new, this is nice, new home entertainment system and free food delivery during the game. For your chance to win, enter the Rangers Return Sweepstakes at msgnetworks.com/RangerSweeps and enjoy Rangers Canes Saturday noon. MSG Network Rangers Return Sweepstakes is presented by the New York Post at 98.7. ESPN.
DiPietro, Canty, and Rothenberg. Weekdays at 10 on 98.7 ESPN.